Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. Tonight we'll be discussing the Copa America Centenario, which is taking place here in the U.S., over the course of about the next month, starting next week. We have a very distinguished panel of experts tonight. We have Mr. Tim Vickery, who has been working for the BBC. He's been living in Brazil since 94. He's been working for the BBC, like I said. He's doing work for ESPN. And he'll be here in the U.S. covering the Copa. Welcome to the show, Tim. How's things going tonight?
Lovely to be here. You know, I've had mixed feelings about this tournament, and I still have. Although, as it gets closer, I'm getting more and more enthusiastic, and I'm getting more and more enthusiastic about going to the States for the first time because I've never been there before, and I arrive in New York, and you know, from our culture, and so much comes from the States, and so much English music has been based as its starting point on Black American music. And just now, I was listening to a song from my adolescence. We used to get down and do a rowing dance to the Gap Band's Oops Upside Your Head. And I'm just listening to it now and thinking, oh, that's where I'm going to be. I'm going to be in the States. I'm going to be in the United States of America. So I'm becoming increasingly enthusiastic about the whole project.
Nice. That's great. Also with us tonight is an old friend, Mr. Juan Arango, who is the color analyst for the Miami FC of the NASL. He'll also be doing the Spanish language broadcast for the CONCACAF for the upcoming Copa Centenario. Welcome to the show, Juan. What's going on?
What's up, man? Doing good. I heard Tim's going to be going over to Bedford-Stuyvesant to be, you know, trying to get some of the roots there as far as, you know, Mos Def and the rap scene over in you know, like Queens and Brooklyn and stuff. So that sounds really cool, man.
It's going to be the hottest day of the year, and you can do something, you can do nothing, or you can do the right thing. That's my main link with Bed-Stuy.
Exactly. There you go. But there you go, man. I mean that's the place to be, you know. And yeah, I'll be traveling. Also, I'll be in Orlando. I'll be in Philadelphia, and I'll be in Boston for, you know, a couple of matches, including the quarterfinal, which promises to be tremendous. If you get, you know, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, or Mexico, you know, a combination of those four in the quarterfinal, so that'll be one of the tremendous matches of the tournament for sure.
The third member of our distinguished panel tonight is Mr. Roberto Rojas, who is the co-host of Low Limit Football. Mr. Rojas also writes for Vavel, among other things. Welcome to the show, Roberto. What's going on?
I'm doing well, James, and I am excited as Tim is, as excited as Juan is, to be a part of this tournament. Obviously, the biggest tournament to happen in the United States since the 1994 World Cup. I'll be falling into the footsteps of my dad, you know, an immigrant coming from Paraguay, going to such a tournament like this. I'll be following in his footsteps, covering such fantastic matches here in what is known as the United States of America.
Speaking of that, I picked out four matches that I just... went through the group stage. I picked out four matches that I thought were intriguing. And just to start the conversation with in the group stage, I picked out on June 4th, we've got Costa Rica versus Paraguay. On the 5th, we've got Mexico versus Uruguay. On the 6th, we've got Argentina versus Chile. And on the 11th, we've got Colombia versus Costa Rica. So I just picked those out of the... out of the what I thought was most intriguing matchups. Tim, what would you say are the most intriguing matchups for you coming into this Copa?
immensely looking forward to USA against Colombia, and what a great way to get the ball rolling. Also looking forward a lot to Brazil against Ecuador. They meet each other very soon again, I think in September, with perhaps more at stake, because this is something that maybe we'll get into over the course of the next few minutes. And I think World Cup qualification is clearly a priority over the Copa America for the South American sides. I wonder if the same is true for the CONCACAF sides. I know much less about them. It's not really my area. And this is something which interests me, because I would have thought that for the CONCACAF sides, this tournament really is an opportunity. And I just wonder if they're going to be more motivated than the sides from South America. What do people think about that?
I mean, from what I've been talking, and I was in Costa Rica with a good friend of yours, Tim, with Paul Saras, doing the CONCACAF Futsal Championships. And there is a bit of anticipation, at least from the Costa Rican side, to be able to see that going on, to really see Costa Rica try and repeat under Machillo Ramirez this time, to be able to see what they were able to do in the World Cup back in 2014 and do it pretty much against some of the same competition that they were able to face in that tournament, especially in Uruguay. But that being said, Mexico also have priorities as far as the Olympic tournament is concerned. The U.S., they really wanted to have a big tournament, especially being the host nation. And what's most important is to see how teams like Jamaica continue growing. I mean, as far as winning it, there's some teams that might be looking at some bigger and probably more priority laden situations, such as maybe trying to get to the next stage of the CONCACAF qualifiers. Yes, that is a big factor. But to see CONCACAF really coming in, all guns blazing, I think that's going to be a very important thing for this tournament, and it'll add that little bit of spice that it needs.
And what about you, Roberto? What matches are most intriguing to you in the group stage?
Well, it's quite ironic that the United States are opening this tournament against Colombia in the same state in which they produced one of their most famous victories in history, the 2-1 victory at the Rose Bowl in the 1994 World Cup. Tim has mentioned, I am really also interested to see Brazil against Ecuador. Ecuador has been spectacular in World Cup qualification so far. Surprising Argentina at the Monumental, defeating teams like Uruguay, and also providing a spectacular performances so far. Of course, another one will be against Mexico-Uruguay in Glendale. Mexico is looking to ride high as one of the best in CONCACAF, if not the best in CONCACAF, against a great side like Uruguay, especially if we know whether or not Luis Suarez will be playing up front. And of course, in Group D, it has to be the rematch of the Copa America final in Chile last year, which, Tim, you definitely remember, Argentina against Chile at Levi Stadium. How much revenge can Argentina finally get, and how much motivation can they get to finally win a international title for the first time in 23 years?
Well, with Argentina and Chile both bringing strong sides, unlike some of the CONMEBOL teams, it looks like Argentina and Chile both are taking the tournament fairly seriously. I question, whether or not Brazil is maybe taking a B-plus side or a B kind of side to a certain extent, maybe looking at the Olympics as more of a thrust for them. What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I think Brazil are a little bit contradictory here, a little bit schizophrenic. They've got themselves over this competition because, and you're right, they clearly established the Olympics as their priority, and that's easy to understand. And for Brazil, Copa America is a ten a penny. The Olympics, they're at home. It's the one title that open to them that they've never won. So they would really, really love to put that right this year. So that's the priority, and I understand that ticket sales to Brazil from the Copa Centenario have been very, very poor indeed. However, the coach's job is on the line. Dunga really is fighting for his job, and a bad Copa America could well mean that he's not even in charge for the Olympics. I mean, it's as serious for him as that. So there are a few the handful of players in the squad who are there for the Olympics, but the rest, it's more or less as strong as he's got. It's more or less the best that he can take. Obviously, that they had to give up Neymar because they wanted Neymar for both, but Barcelona wouldn't play ball, quite rightly. decided that they would only release him for one, and Brazil chose the Olympics. Bad news for Brazil in the last few minutes. Douglas Costa has just pulled out. Now, this is a problem for this tournament. The number of players. I think that in general, the squad lineup was stronger than I'd feared and expected. In some ways, surprisingly so. And I have no idea what Uruguay are thinking of taking their first choice lineup. No idea at all. I think it's madness, especially as the coach has just hit out quite violently at the whole tournament. And you can understand why from Uruguay's point of view, because Uruguay's itinerary is absolutely absurd. It's been drawn up as if it's been drawn up by an adolescent with a felt tip pen. They just crisscross the country all over the place. So quite why Uruguay are risking their strongest squad, risking tiring out their strongest squad, I don't understand. Chile as well. I mean, I know there's a new coach, Pizzi, trying to get his feet under the table, but I think they may pay a price for burning out some of their best players as well, in what is, after all, the oldest squad in the field. But we are beginning to see players drop out, and this is a problem for the tournament, I think. It reminds me, in that sense, a little bit of the 2002 World Cup. The similarity is they both started right at the start of June, whereas usual international tournaments start when the Euros are starting. You've got that extra week or 10 days to recover from the arduous European season. We haven't done that with the Copa. Didn't happen with the 2002 World Cup in order to avoid the rainy season in Japan and South Korea. And that's one of the reasons that World Cup was so strange. A really bizarre results in that World Cup. Teams doing well in that competition who've never done well subsequently. So that is, I think, day by day, that's becoming more of a problem for the Copa America. You know, we've just lost Douglas Costa. You know, we've lost Ortigoza of Paraguay. And day after day after day, we're losing more. And Ecuador might have lost Carlos Cruzo after the friendly against the States the other night. So this is a problem, I think. The timing of the tournament means that a lot of players, they haven't had sufficient time to get over the European season. And those who are there, they could not well not be firing on all cylinders.
And also to piggyback on what Tim was saying, too, I mean, guys like Messi, personally, too, guys like Messi, he's going to be in the game against Honduras in San Juan tomorrow as Argentina get ready. What's he going to do now? Go back to Spain because he has to go to court because of this certain situations that he's having over there as far as having problems with the Spanish government. And then he's going to take a private jet from Spain and go to Santa Clara to meet up with the Argentine national team right before they end up playing Chile. So, I mean, you do have a hectic schedule regardless of how you see it. I mean, and also Tim mentioned that Ricardo Oliveira also out of the lineup as well. Jonas Gonçalves for Brazil. So, I mean, you do see a lot of soldiers starting to go down, and it's pretty much what we're starting to see every summer with these big international tournaments now.
So I'll put it to you, Roberto. We've got these big sides with these issues, but now when you look at a squad like Peru and Paraguay and some of these other sides, Peru, for example, has, I believe it's 11 of 23 players have never played international tournaments before, never suited up for the international squad before. Paraguay has a number of players that have only played, within their domestic league. How are they going to fare in this international competition? Squads like that.
Well, in the course of Paraguay, I'd like to mention and go back to what Tim said. Yes, you're right. Néstor Ortigosa, obviously one of the best penalty kick takers in all of South America, maybe all over the world, given his record, is out. A creative midfielder, someone who was a powerful defensive midfielder who could provide passes to the front line and everything like that. It's a big loss for Paraguay and for Ramon Diaz. You know, what changes will he make in the starting lineup for either a 4-4-2 in a diamond or a regular flat 4-4-2? But then going back into the defense, well, you've also missed out Pablo Aguilar, who is also out of the tournament, meaning that players such as Gustavo Gomez, who's having a fantastic tournament at Lanús, who's going to be playing the playoff against San Lorenzo to decide the winner of the Argentine League, he's going to have to trust you, as well as other players maybe in the left-back position, such as Blas Riveros, who is an 18-year-old recently signed from Basel, currently playing at Olympia. He might get some experience. And you also have a lot of youngsters like Robert Pires da Mota, players like Darío Lescano, who's been doing fantastically for the national team ever since his debut. Juan Iturbe, the new Argentine Paraguayan player who's finally decided to play for the Paraguayan national team. Darius Gonzalez, who's had a fantastic Copa America last year. And Antonio Sanabria as well, who comes in to replace the old guard and wear the same shirt as Roque Santa Cruz did for this tournament. So a lot of youth in that level for the La Roja. As for Peru, well, in a group with Brazil, Ecuador, and Haiti, Ricardo Gareca's side is definitely looking to pick more of a young squad. You know, you got players, you have the experienced players such as Pedro Gallese, Yotun, Paulo Guerrero, obviously their main player, but also a lot of young players in this squad as well, mostly using on the domestic side. And they're looking at this tournament as a big experience, maybe to use for the next World Cup in 2022, given that the qualification that they've been having so far, Peru, has been abysmal, and it's not been fantastically well for Peru. So they're going to take this tournament as a bit of experience, and hopefully they can surprise like they did in the last two Copa Americas, where they reached third place in Argentina and Chile.
Yeah, Peru is sitting at something like 50-1 to get out of the group even. So, I mean, it may be a bridge too far for them to even get out of the group, looking at the sides that are above them. I'll go back to Tim. Tim, I forgot to mention it at the top of the show, but happy birthday. I believe it was yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
I've had too many of them already. When you reach my age, there's no congratulations. The only thing you conclude is that getting older is better than the alternative.
Yeah, well, I'm still older than you, so I know just
and
what
and always will be.
And always will be. But one thing that intrigues me about this Brazil side and Dunga, and it just confounds me, is the saga of David Luiz. And what and just why does he not use Thiago in his formation? Can you bring some light to why Dunga seems impossible to understand in building his defense?
He's difficult to understand anyway, and he's someone who thrives on conflict. And that's how he turned himself into not a great player, but a pretty good player. And he was a fairly limited player in the 1990 World Cup as a holding midfielder. By 1994, he'd improved greatly in terms of his passing, and that was as a result of facing all of the criticism that he faced after Brazil's failure in 1990. He was the scapegoat for a lot of it, and he used that conflict and that anger to make himself into a far better player. There must always, with him, there must be conflict, which is all right if you're a player. It's probably all right if you're a team captain. But once you become the team coach, I think it becomes much, much harder to administer. And part, I think, of Brazil's failure in his first spell in the 2010 World Cup in South Africa was the fact that emotionally he was absolutely out of his depth. With Thiago Silva, now remember, Dunga defines himself as Brazil's World Cup winning captain in 1994. He watched from the stands when Brazil lost the World Cup on home ground in 2014, which, for all of the technical deficiencies of the team, was primarily an emotional collapse. You know, you remember that the team were crying before the game, crying during the game, crying after the game. It was a veil of tears. Now, Thiago Silva, although he was suspended for the fateful 7-1 against Germany, he was the captain of the team. He doesn't have, although he is, I think, one of the world's great centre-backs, I don't really think he has the characteristics of a captain. And we saw that very clearly when the second-round game against Chile went to a penalty shootout. Now, Thiago Silva, he sat away from the rest of his players, sobbing his heart out, just sitting on a ball and refused to take a penalty kick. And for Dunga, who, as I said, defines himself as the captain, that was unforgivable. So he was against Thiago Silva from that moment. So the first thing that he did when he came in as coach for his second spell was he stripped Thiago Silva of the captaincy and he left him on the bench. Now, he got a chance during the last Copa America and gave away a silly penalty against Paraguay that in the end ended up costing Brazil qualification. That match went to a penalty shootout in the quarterfinal and Brazil were eliminated. And from that moment, he didn't want to know any more. With David Luiz, he persevered and persevered and persevered. But it seems like a disastrous display against Uruguay and Luis Suarez at the end of March has put paid to David Luiz. Another one that he's fallen out with over the years a few times is Marcelo, the Real Madrid left-back. Now, right at the start of the first Dunga reign, when Marcelo was a teenage fullback, Dunga gave him his international debut, and he scored on debut, and he looked like a future star. But after that, and Dunga, he just goes on and on and on about commitment. Commitment, 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 commitment. And he didn't think Marcelo showed enough commitment. He might have been justified on one or two occasions. There was a time, there was a friendly that Brazil played against Scotland, and Marcelo managed to persuade Brazil's coaching staff that he was injured and couldn't play. And he sent an email back to the Real Madrid, his club, saying, "I've managed to fool them and they've let me off." But oh, the dangers of modern technology. That email, by mistake, he also sent it to Brazil's coaching staff. And once Dunga had a look at that, you know, that was a big, big black mark against Marcelo, and explains why he didn't go to the 2010 World Cup. And part of the explanation why he's not in the Brazil squad either. So Dunga must have these little conflict things to thrive on. If he was kind of left in a room, he'd end up arguing with himself just to stop himself getting bored. But it really is, it's approaching make or break time. And had his team lost to Paraguay at the end of March in that World Cup qualifier, he might already have gone. They scored a last gasp equaliser, and he really is backs to the wall. He may not survive if Brazil have another disappointing campaign.
So, over to you, Juan, as our CONCACAF guy on here. When I look at the teams that are coming to this tournament from CONCACAF, it seems to me there's a big gap in quality between the CONMEBOL teams and the CONCACAF teams that are participating in this tournament. Am I wrong in saying that there is that gap? And do you expect any surprises from the CONCACAF sides? I guess particularly maybe Mexico or Costa Rica or the U.S.?
When you start to look at CONCACAF, it's really a mixed bag that you're getting. I mean, yeah, you do have some teams that have been able to make relative statements. Mexico perennially has done well in Copa America today. It's embarrassing. I mean, it really is. I mean, they look lost at times. At least, you see that Michael Bradley has the wherewithal to at least be able to find his place in the world when he's playing as a number six. You do see the U.S. losing some connection when you don't have, the U.S. is lacking that different player, that player that has, I mean, and you probably might be finding it at least in the early stage with Christian Pulisic. You're seeing them have that little bit of malandrage, that little bit of maliciousness, street smarts. The U.S. are still a very robotic football culture. When you start looking at Costa Rica, yeah, you might see him from a defensive standpoint maybe not be as good as when Jorge Luis Pinto was the coach. But so, I mean, it depends on which South American team you're looking at, because if you start comparing Mexico and Panama and even Costa Rica, comparing them to Bolivia, I mean, then you start, it's a different situation. If you start comparing them to Argentina or Chile, then you're going to have a completely different answer coming from me. So, it depends on who you're talking to or what teams you're trying to compare as far as that's concerned. Because CONMEBOL in the past few years have started to see the haves and have-nots really open up that chasm. I mean, the big question, too, is, if you start talking about CONCACAF teams like Venezuela, how are they going to be doing under Rafael Dudamel and the big generational change that is going on with the Vino Tinto right now? Are you going to start seeing the younger players, the Salomon Rondons, the Añors? You start seeing, the better quality generation starting to come in for Venezuela to start to step up after a dismal World Cup campaign. On the other end, are you going to start looking at Panama? Are they going to be able to make a big statement this time around? I mean, because that's a team that everybody's been talking for over a decade. Hey, this team is about to break through. This team's about to break through. And you're starting to see the generations go from one hand to the other. You see the generational baton switch, if you will, going from one end to the other. How, are they going to start showing any tangible results with Bolillo Gomez as the coach? I mean, those are some of the question marks that are there. So, I mean, as far as, is there a gap between CONMEBOL and CONCACAF? Yes, there is. Now, but when you start looking at individual teams, you can start, you know, kind of, you know, shifting positions, especially that bottom portion as far as who the teams are. You could probably start seeing some CONCACAF teams mixing in with the Venezuelas, with the Perus, and even with the Bolivians.
Okay. Roberto, why don't you kind of add some flavor to that, especially when it comes to Paraguay, maybe Bolivia. How would you compare, especially those two sides, maybe Peru, to what you see on CONCACAF?
Well, there is a lot of a gap, as Juan has mentioned. There is quite a gap between both confederations. Paraguay obviously have been consistent, basically. You can maybe compare them to a CONCACAF side, perhaps maybe a Honduras or a Costa Rica. They've been able to qualify to four consecutive World Cups in CONMEBOL, which is the toughest World Cup qualifier in the world when you have to deal with such amazing conditions, wild fans, and everything that has to be under that with Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Uruguay, and so on and so forth. You can start comparing the youth on that team that Ramon Diaz has been doing and see a rejuvenation happening after the failure to qualify for their own neighbors tournament in 2014. So you can definitely see something among those lines for Paraguay, especially with a coach and a winner like Ramon Diaz. As for Bolivia, they've always been perennial, I guess you could say, abysmal so far, ever since failing to qualify for the World Cup after 1994. And it's a big loss to see that the best player, Alejandro Chumachero, the strongest, is not on that team. He has been spectacular in the Copa Libertadores, and I thought maybe if they were able to surprise something, especially what they did in the Copa America last year when they got out of the group with Chile, Mexico, and Ecuador, anything is possible for the Bolivia side, but it's all going to be confusing, especially with the chaos that has been happening in Bolivia, at the Bolivia FA, with the different types of coaches that have been happening in the past few years. And obviously, when you mention Peru, as I mentioned, it's a young talent, a young team with Kyle Gareca, looking to rejuvenate the new, something that hasn't been seen from Peru since qualifying for the 82 World Cup. So this tournament might prove something big, and maybe pull a surprise, as most tournaments are, like the Copa America. You're going to see a surprise there and there. Maybe the CONMEBOL teams like Bolivia, Peru, Paraguay are going to slow up for something. Or the CONCACAF sides like Jamaica, Haiti, Panama, and Costa Rica, especially in the hard group for Costa Rica when you're having to deal with the host, Colombia, and Paraguay. So it's going to be very interesting to see what both sides are going to do. But in terms of the gap, it is immensely huge from CONMEBOL. In fact, I can even see a statement that Tim always notes all the time. The standard and depth and quality of South American national teams has never been higher. But when comparing them to the club level, it's never been lower and worse than it has been.
Okay. I'd like to dig in a little bit on one of the matchups that intrigues me the most, which is Chile against Argentina. And one of the debates that I see in my mind is, when Argentina comes up against Chile, who do you think they're going to play at striker? Do you think against Chile, do you think they're going to play Agüero or Higuaín against that a Chilean side? I'll put that to you, Tim.
Well, I think we can confirm that it's probably going to be one or the other. I remember when they qualified for Brazil 2014, playing both of them with Di Maria as part of the midfield trio, something that they couldn't do during the World Cup, which the stars didn't have enough gas in the tank, and they ended up playing a much more defensive style of football in the tournament. And this is one of the things that continually blights tournaments, which is ended season tiredness. But since the World Cup, Martino's interpretation of 4-3-3 has had either Agüero or Higuaín, with Di Maria in the front three rather than the midfield three. I don't know. I suspect, and well, you know, they got the warm-up friendly against Honduras. I suspect that Higuain might get the nod. I don't know, but what intrigues me much more about Argentina is what they do defence, because I think that is the key question to keep hovering over the Argentine national team for some time now. And ever since the 2010 World Cup, you know, all of the coaches, we've had three different coaches, and they've all tried to try and kind of replicate the Barcelona 4-3-3, the structure in which Messi has, after a long wait, has gone some way to recapture his Barcelona form for Argentina. But there is a key difference, and that is that Barcelona defend high up the field, press like mad, and Messi is receiving the ball 30 or 40 metres from the opposing goal. Argentina at centre-back are slow, and they're not particularly good, and the embarrassment of riches that they have in attack, they don't have at all in defence. So their defensive line operates much, much deeper. And the consequence of this on Messi, I think, is interesting, because it means that Messi has to drop so much further away from the opposition goal in order to pick up the ball. And it's this fact that Messi has to cover much more ground is, I think, one of the explanations for his end-of-season burnout, if you like. Now, Argentina have to resolve this problem. They've made some, I think, the cupboard is a little bit bare. They don't have a lot. I mean, Victor Cuesta, they've called up. He wasn't even in the original list of 40, but they called him up at centre-back. That's a 27-year-old centre-back. You would have thought that if he were the solution, we might have been aware of his quality before now. There's a lot of faith being put in Ramiro Funes Mori, who may well play both the Copa America and the Olympics. Is quicker, is younger than the old guard of Argentina centre-backs. Is he really trustworthy? Do you really think that you can rely on him? For my mind, he has a few too many mistakes in him. But that, I think, is the most interesting thing to look at from an Argentina point of view. Chile also, on how will they defend? Coach Juan Antonio Pizzi is obviously a much more conventional figure than Sampaoli as a coach, and who isn't? And he's usually a 4-2-3-1 man, and typically with a target man centre-forward. Now, how does he square that? How will Chile defend? Will Chile continue to try and defend high up the field? Now, even against Argentina, you know, Sampaoli in the Copa America final, he tweaked the characteristics a little bit. He was more pragmatic. I think the key to that triumph was the use of Arangiz as a midfielder with great lung power, not bursting forward so much, but giving his priority, trying to isolate Messi from his teammates. Arangiz has missed the vast majority of the season, has just come back and will be desperate to have a good tournament. So that, I think, is a matchup that I'm interested to see from the Argentina-Chile perspective. Where will both teams play their defensive lines, and how will Arangiz play against Messi?
You know what? It was interesting you said that about, because just on Tuesday, you saw Tata Martino begin to implement both Higuain and Agüero in practice. He was starting to use both of them. And so, I mean, that kind of threw the Argentine media off a little bit. But as far as Saturday's match, Higuain's going to start up top. It's going to be Messi, Higuain, and Di Maria in that 4-3-3 that Tim was mentioning. So, I mean, That's going to be interesting too, because I mean, and I got the chance to be able to call that Copa America final last year, and it's also what Tim mentioned, how much Messi has to drop back, but also the lack of movement that Argentina has compared to Barcelona that really hinders Messi sometimes. And it's like, okay, fine, let's see what Leo can do to get us out of this one. And I think there's I guess I'm going to borrow a cliche, that Messi dependency as far as just trying to move that ball around a little bit more and find Agüero instead of Agüero trying to make himself available to find the space, or Higuain or whomever. But also the big question is, you have a player like Javier Pastore that's, you know, he's injured, he's not in good form. Same thing with Ezequiel Lavezzi, who Martino said he wants to have on the line, he wants to have in the United States for this tournament. And Lavezzi, they're saying, well, you know what, he's on the national team because, well, you know, he cracks a lot of jokes, he makes Messi laugh, and he really, man, he serves up some really good mates. So, I mean, right there, you start seeing that that's a major problem when you start having these types of players in there that, is it Messi's buddy? Or, you know, there's other controversies as well going on, and some fair and some mostly unjust going towards Lionel Messi.
One starts to worry about whether or not the midfield can probably work on this. You know, do you play Mascherano and Biglia, or who do you play up in the 4-3-3? You play Banega, or do you play Pastore, who has also been rumored that he could have missed it, but in the end, he will be coming to this tournament. Going back to the defense, as Tim mentioned, you're looking at Funes Mori, who has been quite questionable. At least I've questioned him a bit when he moves to Everton from River Plate. You know, he is quicker than most center backs that Argentina has had, especially a player like Martin Demichelis, for example. But how reliable is he? You know, what about the fullbacks of Argentina? You know, can Gabriel Mercado continue his fine form at international level and provide the ball correctly up into the front line of Argentina? You know, how well can Marcos Rojo do on the left? And going back to your question, James, for me, I can't see anyone besides Aguero, honestly. You know, his form has been great. And obviously, there has been a lot of pressure from Higuain on this Argentine national team. It's been like that ever since the 2014 World Cup, when he missed various chances and got the offside goal against Germany, and as well as missing the penalty against Chile in the penalty shootout in the Copa America final. So how much trust does Tata Martino have on him? Well, we're going to definitely see that happen against Honduras and see which of the two, if both of them play. As well as going back to players who should have been on this squad, I think Paulo Dybala would have made a reasonable pick. But honestly, you're looking at players who have already been, that's four strikers. You got Messi, who shifted from striker to right wing. You know, you have Di Maria, and you have Lionel Messi playing the wings. Is that enough? Probably not. And going back to Chile, yes, Tim is right. The game that the America was because of the intelligence of Charles Aranguiz against Lionel Messi. And it's going to be very interesting to see him back on the Chilean side after missing the majority of the 2015-2016 season through injury at Bayer Leverkusen. It's always going to be interesting who's going to replace Jorge Valdivia, who is surprisingly not being called up to the national team. You know, do we see Eduardo Vargas playing attacking midfielder and seeing Alexis play as a sole striker? Who knows? It's a very intriguing matchup, but I would not be surprised if this is going to be a goal fest. And we might see it's for me it's a coin toss, honestly, but you have to give more confidence to Argentina going forward. But then again, it's anyone's game.
One team we haven't
talked about.
Go ahead, Juan.
Just piggybacking on what both of you said, yeah, Chavez Aranguiz is going to be key for Chile. But it was interesting to be listening to Juan Antonio Pizzi's press conference today, and they were asking him, you know, what's the most important thing? Discipline. I mean, you know, take of that what you will, especially with the Copa America last year and some of the subplots that went on with Vidal and everything else that was going on there. But he said, look, you know, guys, I'm not as distant to what was being done before. My way of seeing football is not that much different than that. So he's also having a delicate balance between not totally tinkering with something that's working, and at the same time, you know, not trying to try and change something and adapt it, because there's a certain level of work that needs to be done in order to continue evolving with this program. So there is a fine line that he does have to walk in order to, first of all, continue to have the success, to return to form, and more importantly, to keep the players happy. Because once you start getting the Vidals, the Alexis Sanchez, the Aranguiz, the Claudio Bravo start getting upset, then you start seeing that there will be a little bit of a mutiny, potentially.
One team we haven't spent any time on is the U.S. side.
We can skip over that if you want.
Well, but there's one aspect of this tournament that I find both controversial and intriguing, and that is the fact that a lot of the games are going to be played on turf or some variation of turf, which really only the U.S. players have a lot of experience with. And what, you know, will that be a factor? I don't know. Tim?
Yeah, I only found this out on Friday, on Tuesday, actually. I was in ignorance of this. And then it was pointed out to me that a lot of the stadiums are synthetic turf. I think there's one that's mixed, and maybe five of them are synthetic. Now, I know nothing about this at all. I suppose the players will be happy that the matches are taking place at night and not in the afternoon. But this really is one for you who are USA based and are watching the games. And I would love all of your opinions on this, on how much of an influence you think this will have.
Juan?
It's going to have a pretty big impact, to be quite honest with you. I mean, there are, as you guys mentioned, most of the U.S. players are the ones that are more accustomed to playing on this surface. It's going to be faster for some, but also there's also the risk of injury. So many are going to be a little bit more apprehensive. There are a couple of players on the Mexican side that are accustomed to, the ones that play at least in the Mexican League, that have gone over to Tijuana and have played against Xolos and have found that particular scenario is one that really has been favoring them. But overall, yeah, it's going to be a big adaptation. But also, you start looking, there are synthetic pitches that have been constructed in South America. In Argentina, there's a couple in Rosario. There's a couple in Buenos Aires. Peru has a couple. One of the pitches that was used for the under-17 World Cup back in 2005 was one of those venues.
And most of them have gone because the players just absolutely detested them.
You're absolutely really, right.
The players' union went mad about them because absolutely. The quality of the game and the number of injuries as well.
Well, I mean, if you start looking at what Saprissa did, I mean, for about a decade, while Jorge Vergara was the owner, he implemented the artificial turf there. And of course, it was a nightmare for anyone that played at Saprissa, even United States when they had to play their national team games there. That was an absolute nightmare. Now they ripped that up and they played on. And it's funny that the first season that they have the natural grass is the first year in a couple of years that Saprissa doesn't win the league title and ends up having a great deal of dissent and a great deal of problems. So, I mean, it's kind of ironic that it happens at a club like Saprissa. Same thing with Alajuelense. So Costa Rica is another team that's very accustomed to playing on artificial turf. I mean, most of those players that have played for Saprissa, for Alajuelense, even for Herediano as well, are accustomed to those types of situations. But for South American players and South American players that are based over in Europe, that's going to be a tough adaptation. And what's been even more ironic is that there's certain teams, Colombia right now, who happen to be in Miami training. I've been at their practice the past couple of days. They're training on grass. So, I mean, they won't have that situation as much. But, yeah, it is going to be an issue for several teams.
If I can just butt in here quite rudely.
This is
news which is hot off the press. I said earlier on, Douglas Costa out of the Brazil squad there with an injury. And Brazil have just called up one South American player who does have a certain amount of experience with the synthetic turf. Kaká, back in the Brazil squad for the Copa.
Yeah, I just saw that.
I did too.
Yeah, I just saw it. You're right. I mean, so Kaká, and especially in one of the matches, will be in Orlando. So you know for sure that that's going to be pretty much kind of a home game for Brazil, especially with the. I mean, if you go to Orlando, guys, you see Kaká is their big star. I mean, Kaká, to a lesser extent, is kind of what Shaquille O'Neal was back in the 90s in Orlando. I mean, you drive up I-4 and you see posters of Kaká. You see, you know, commercials with Kaká. So, I mean, to have him and be able to play in Orlando is going to be quite a treat. So that's going to be an interesting news story.
Looking at my Twitter feed at the moment with Brazilian journalists, they're not very happy about this. This is quite funny, I think. He's full of...
Because actually, you know who told me? I mean, it was Alisson, the guy that covers Cruzeiro.
All right. Cruzeiro, and also just put up here, Dunga has dropped a football and he's put up an ambassador. perhaps that's a little bit disrespectful to Kaká, but that's how many in Brazil see him these days.
Well, you know what? You know who else is getting that too right now is Nicolás Loredo of Uruguay. I mean, it's imminent that he's going to go to the Seattle Sounders. And you talk to people in Argentina, man, and they're saying, you know what? I mean, why is he going to retire at 27? I mean, that's those are the exact words a lot of journalists. I mean, he's going to retire in MLS. I mean, at 27, I mean, I guess he doesn't want to play in the World Cup in Russia. So, I mean, it's a topic that really, you know, I mean, and even with the Jovinko story that came out too, I mean, just kind of giving it like a parallel, you know, the people that really were offended over the comments that Antonio Conte made of him, of Jovinko not getting called up to the Italian national team. I mean, it just shows you that at least football here in the United States still has to overcome that image of being a retirement league, because for all the Jovinkos and all the Lodeiros, you're still getting the Lampards, the Gerards, the Pirlos, and the David Villas who are looking for one final paycheck.
So true. So when we look back over, you know, some teams that actually have a real chance to win this tournament, you know, clearly we talked about Argentina. We've talked about Brazil now. Colombia. Does anybody think that Mexico has a real shot to win this tournament?
I do.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I do. They're the team that at least has to travel.
That's right.
It's
up for them, isn't it, really?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was funny. I was watching Caracol the other day, the Colombian network, and they're saying it's set up for the U.S. and Mexico to win it. You know, we're kind of giving them, you know, we're making it easier on them to be able to win this tournament, or at least challenge for the title. So, I mean,
if you're Uruguay, you're in the same group as Mexico, and you look at your respective itineraries, it's a joke, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, that's
Uruguay just cross back and forth. Mexico don't have to do that.
No. Mexico stayed pretty much within, you know, the you know, they stayed within the southeast and just the southwest, excuse me, and then they head to Texas. That's about it. And maybe, depending if they're in first or second place, they'll head up to Boston. Maybe. But that's when you start to see them travel. Argentina has to do the same thing, too. They have to go Santa Clara, Chicago, Seattle. And that's really been a major problem for Argentina as far as the logistical standpoint to be able to set up their camp. They were looking originally to do how they were in Beaga when they were in Belo Horizonte, to be able to stay over at Atlético Mineiro's complex and be able to at least be able to filter themselves out in different, you know, to different stadiums. Here in the United States, that's not going to happen. I mean, it's not planned out that way, or it's not logistically possible because of the amount of traveling they have to do. But, you know, I mean, the U.S. does have to do their traveling as well. I mean, they have to play in Santa Clara. They have to play in Philadelphia. So, I mean, they do have certain issues that they have to overcome as far as travel is concerned, just like they did in Brazil. But they do have that setup where they are the home side. They can go and train pretty much anywhere they want.
I think the same could be said for Paraguay as well. You know, they open up in Orlando, then they travel west to Pasadena, and then they end against the United States in Philadelphia. So you're basically going one side of the country to another. And yeah, as Juan mentioned, Mexico do have the shortest travel itinerary, and that might prove well for the for Mexico. And going back to the synthetic fields that Jim was talking about, Paraguay have been training in Orlando at the ESPN World Wide World of Sports a few days before it, and so they're really prepared to play on the artificial turf at Camp
Exactly.
and then play at Pasadena, you know, in undergrass, and then go back to Lincoln Financial Field, which is a mix of the as Tim mentioned. So that's going to be it's going to be very interesting to see how these teams, especially the South Americans who are playing in Europe, who have absolutely no experience of playing in these types of pitches, is going to field. And by the way, as well, it is absolutely important that this is going to be played in the evening, late afternoon, dusk time, not in the daytime that happened at USA 94 under 100-degree, 110-degree weather. So that might prove well, and the heat might not be a factor for some of these players.
Yeah, adding to that as well, Foxborough is another one. Gillette Stadium is another field that's artificial turf.
That's right.
But what they tend to do is to put grass over that. Now, that's also a risk, too, if you start looking at it, because then, you know, what if the different, you know, bits of grass start moving around? Do they start shifting, which has been a tendency in certain friendlies, because they'll install that grass hours before kickoff. So we'll see how that plays out as the days go by, and also the maintenance of it, because obviously, you know, seeing how if MLS won't be playing there for a few days. And also you have three matches being played over in Foxborough. It'll be interesting to see how that's maintained, or if they're going to start bring them in, bring them out. I don't know what they're going to do, but that's going to be a major topic of discussion, because one thing for sure, Robert Kraft is not taking those gridiron lines off. That's one thing he is not going to do.
No, he won't. As far as the, you know, just to finish up on the United States, does anybody think that there's a chance that they're going to get out of the group?
Surely it will be a disaster if they don't get out of the group. And obviously, I know less about them than you do. But I did watch the Ecuador game yesterday. And I think if you were the States, you'd have come out of that thinking pretty good about yourself. I mean, the first half was poor, very, very poor. But what a great performance from Johnny Brooks at centre-back that meant that even when Ecuador were dominant, they didn't really have many clear-cut chances. And then you get a sense of that there's some depth in the squad with what happened in the second half, especially when Mickey Bradley was placed in the centre of midfield to organise the game from deeper. And this very interesting 17-year-old from Dortmund who, I think, as Juan said earlier on, just gives them that something extra. You know, and for me, it's inconceivable that the USA don't get out of the group. I think it would be an absolute disaster. Wouldn't that be the end of Klinsmann if they don't get out of the group?
Pretty much.
Well, maybe not.
I mean, yes and no. Here's the thing, and I've been saying it for the past couple of years. Jurgen Klinsmann's a very smart businessman. I mean, he has that contract on lockdown. I mean, the day he gets sacked, he is going to have to. I mean, U.S. soccer is. I mean, not to say that they don't have money, but they're going to have to, you know, pay him a good chunk of change to be able to step away. And on top of that, they're going to have to pay another salary in addition to that. They have way too many responsibilities because they're also sacking not just a coach but also a technical director. So you do have a guy that's playing has two different hats, and at the same time, you know, he's sometimes his best and his worst critic. And sometimes when he looks at himself in the mirror, hey, you know, who's the best coach of all? You are, Jurgen, you are. And he really doesn't have that self-criticism that many would think he has, because at times when things are well, it's because of him doing a great job coaching. But when things aren't going so well, it's because of the players not being committed. I mean, it's kind of a Dunga syndrome that you see with him as well, because he questions commitment. He questions players who are going to MLS or going from Europe to MLS, you know, commitment as far as their progress. And to be honest with you, football's a business, and if they want to go wherever they want, that's up to them. You know, if they want to go back to MLS, that's their prerogative. But, you know, those are the players that you have. It's not like the U.S. has a great deep pool of players with a great deal of talent. You have a lot of players with similar capabilities, but very limited extras as far as intangibles are concerned. So, I mean, yeah, they can come out, but at the same time, just as... One thing that really helps them is that underdog card. I mean, that really kind of gives them that little bit of extra push. But I wouldn't be surprised if they get knocked out of the group stage. And to me, if they do, I mean, fine. You know, it's supposed to happen. And I think the media is kind of like bracing for that. But at the same time, do not be surprised if they advance to the next stage. Because that's a team that has the capability to grind things out, to really make things as uncomfortable as possible, and they try and hang in there for as long as they possibly can, and they have a break or two go their way, and they can get a victory. Now, from that being executed to that happening, there's still quite a bit of distance.
Well, certainly Brad Guzan has to play extremely well for that to happen.
And John Brooks, too. I mean, you have to have a central defense play well, yep. And Michael Bradley play well. You have to have a lot of players playing well for the U.S. to do. You don't have a player that can offer a great deal of individuality to say, you know what, they're going to tear it up. You know, you don't have a player on the U.S., you don't have a Landon Donovan anymore that he can go and say, you know what, I can carry this team on my back for stretches and be able to lift them up to the next level.
The other intriguing group matchups to me is, you know, who wins Group D, whether it's Argentina or Chile. I suppose that really depends on their head-to-head matchup. And Group C, whether it's Uruguay or Mexico. And once again, that depends. Go ahead.
No, I think that Mexico Uruguay match is going to depend on Luis Suarez's status. You know, how will you?
Right now they're saying that he's probably not going to be until quarters.
Until quarters, right. And there you go.
So I mean, you might see a repeat performance of what happened in Copa America, where they were just struggling to stay alive and kind of grind their way to the next round. Or at the same time, I mean, I'm saying this, and Luis Suarez was also absent when Uruguay beat Colombia 3-0 at the Estadio Centenario. So I mean, it depends on how everyone gets to that stage. And to me, the big wild card in that particular group is going to be Jamaica. Who is Jamaica going to be able to take points away from? And that's going to be the difference between one team advancing or one team not. It's who Jamaica takes points away from in that particular group.
Absolutely.
Do you think Jamaica is capable of taking points away from either of those sides?
Yes, they are. 100%. Yes, they are. They are. I mean, I'm not saying they're going to win. I'm just saying take points. Winnie Schaefer... Yeah, I mean, Winnie Schaefer's done a tremendous bit of work over in Jamaica. I mean, he's really gotten a group of tremendous athletes. I mean, if you know, some of these guys, if they weren't eligible to run for the 4x100 or 4x200s in Rio, I mean, these guys are pretty darn close to being able to do so. I mean, they have a good skill set. Maybe that first touch is still lacking in Jamaican football as well as the finishing, but Winnie Schaefer's been able to grab all the positive attributes and consolidate them into a very smooth running team. I'm sorry to use a pun there, but it's very, you see a very cohesive group, a very embattled group that can really cause some problems for Jamaica. And you saw when they played in the Gold Cup last year against Mexico, they put up a good fight. I mean, obviously, Mexico would end up winning 3-1 in the final without any help from the referees that time, but still, nonetheless, it's still a very competitive side that, depending on how they do in this tournament, that's the fate of the others in the group as well.
And also, to go back to that statement, you look at how Jamaica have been doing in the Copa America, being finalists, having defeated the United States, the host, and while they did do poorly against Mexico in the final, they still had a fantastic performance, especially coming off of Copa America, where nothing was expected of them. You would have thought that they would have been trashed by Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay. They ended up only losing 1-0 in all three of the matches. So you have to give credit when credit is due to the Jamaicans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because in Chile last year, I mean, the running joke from many of the journalists in Argentina and Uruguay, oh, well, I guess Usain Bolt's not playing today. I mean, and that's that. I'd be talking to him, and hey, what's the lineup? Oh, well, Usain Bolt's not playing for Jamaica. And obviously, my Jamaican counterparts in the studio weren't too happy about that. But, I mean, they understood, and they saw the progress from each match. Despite them losing 1-0, you saw that there was a great deal of progress. And what helped them is that they had only 2 weeks to get ready for a Gold Cup, and they just slid in and started doing a good job there. So, I mean, it's a team that really comes in with a good deal of momentum, maybe not so much from World Cup qualifiers, but still, they do have an idea of what they have to play. They have an identity already instilled by Winnie Schaefer. And, of course, having a coach that's already been experienced at the World Cup level, that really helps a great deal.
All right. So, Roberto, give us one thing to watch out for in the Copa Centenario that we may not be thinking about?
Well, the diversity of fans, the fact that this country has represented the meaning of a melting pot. I feel that despite the ticket prices have been a bit controversial, cheapest prices going around $60, $50 on Ticketmaster, you're still going to see a bunch of fans, something that has been seen like in the 94 World Cup, because in the United States, you see so many different cultures of the countries participating, Colombian Americans, Brazilian Americans, Argentine Americans, Costa Ricans, Ecuadorians, I can go on, Mexicans, obviously, the leading factor. It's going to be a lot of fans coming out to support their own nations. And I think that's all that has to matter for such a tournament like this. The fact that the fans can at least come and try to influence maybe a part of the game, if not all of them, and see all the different types of diversity that this country has to offer, and why it is a spectacular tournament. Despite all the controversy that has been made, I hope that it is a spectacular tournament where we see the top stars in a tournament that celebrates on a day or on a month in which we celebrate the centenary of the starting process that ended up becoming the first World Cup in 1930. The Copa America was the major influence for the World Cup. And so, to celebrate 100 years in the United States, which seemed a bit controversial at the start, I think that the optimism and expectations, and I feel that Tim and Juan agree with me on this, it's just going to be intense because of the amount of diversity that you're going to see in this country, as well as the many of star players that will be on the pitches in the United States.
And Juan, what's one thing to watch out for that people may not be thinking of?
I mean, one thing that we've been talking about, I mean, we've had more discussion on whether this tournament should be played, whether this tournament should not be played, you know, all the other types of you know, controversies that have been surrounding this tournament, everything else. At the end of the day, what's going to help us enamor ourselves with the game again is what happens on the pitch. I mean, I'm just hoping that we see a tremendous product on the field. That's what I want to see at the end of the day. I want to be enamored again by football. I mean, it's been a very tough year for football fans, individually and collectively, and I think this is the opportunity for many to be enamored again with what's going on and being able to want to see the headlines be, you know, so-and-so scored, you know, a hat trick. So-and-so did so great. Oh, this team is doing phenomenal. Not what's going on outside, you know, the extracurricular stuff. I mean, hearing, you know, Sergio Haldway and the money that he was able to finagle in order just to get, you know, a private jet to go and fly to Brazil back and forth on a consistent basis, or the other types of news that have emerged in the past year and change. I mean, we're coming close to the one-year anniversary of FIFAgate. And, you know, I want to hear something different. I want to hear, you know, see great football and enjoy and have a laugh and be able to go and sit with people and say, man, what a game we just saw. That's really what I want people to enjoy. And I want people to fall in love. And I just, you know, both fans of football and even potential new fans of football here in the United States to see this and say, man, you know what? I got to follow this because this really kicks ass. And I really want to be a part of it. So, I mean, that's what I'm really looking
for. Especially for us Americans.
Yeah, for Americans, I mean, you know, for us Latinos to be able to tell Americans, hey, this game's for real. This is the real deal. And keep the momentum growing and make this sport really special. It has the potential to do here in the
That it's not a Heineken commercial?
Well, it depends who you're hanging out with. I mean, if it's some of the females that are there, I don't mind it. But you know what? I mean, you know, if it's some of the dudes, forget it. No, I don't want any of those. You know, if it's the girls from a Heineken commercial, bring them on. I don't care.
Oh yeah.
All right, Tim. I'll give you the last word.
I think one of the things that intrigues me is where we're heading with this. When I talk about this, I'm talking about cooperation between CONMEBOL and CONCACAF, because I think there is scope. I think there is a desire on both sides for more cooperation while retaining their separate identities. I think there is a desire for more cooperation, and I think this could be especially interesting in the future at club level. And we've talked earlier on, I think a couple of people mentioned the MLS, for all of its progress, it still has a little bit of a credibility problem. The South American club football has all, it has the tradition, it doesn't have a credibility problem, but it's lagging, it doesn't have the momentum that the MLS has been building up. So you can see a natural fit. You can see what both sides have to gain from each other. Now, how this proceeds is going to be very interesting, because I think it will proceed. And there are some worrying things here. And if you were one of the minor countries in CONCACAF, you'd be worried about this, because you'd see yourself being carved out. That would be a risk. Another risk is just in terms of say, a club competition involving teams from both hemispheres, the amount of travelling time for a club competition. I think it would be a real burden on the players. But a tournament like this happening for the Copa Centenario, a tournament for the best clubs in CONCACAF with your Champions League and the best clubs from the Copa Libertadores, I think that could really have legs. So I'm sure that this competition that we're going to see next month in the United States is a move towards greater cooperation, and that's something which intrigues me.
Very good. Well, This is Jim Hart for These Football Times, signing off with a big special thanks to Tim Vickery, Juan Arango, and Roberto Rojas. Until next time, be the change you want to see in the world. Thanks for listening, and good night.
That was great, guys.